This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey!
Oh. Hi.
Hi, how are you? This is Anna.
Shireen is here. And today we have a really amazing conversation with a really amazing person. Gabrielle Horton is here with us today. We talk about growing up in LA, working in politics, finding podcasting, and going on to produce award-winning podcasts, including one that she's making right now about the crisis in the medical field concerning Black women.
Yeah, it's a great conversation, and you should all be following her work. So
yeah,
get excited.
Get excited and listen to Natal, and you're going to find out what that is in this episode. Stay tuned.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hello, Anna.
Hi, Shireen.
Wow, what another day, another hot summer day. How was your weekend, Anna?
You know, I got a COVID test. I'm negative, which is good.
Great. I'm glad.
Just always trying to be COVID negative.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally did nothing else. I slept for most of yesterday for no reason. I wasn't really that exhausted. I was so tired of just watching TV that I was like,
yeah,
I'm going to try and read. And then immediately, as soon as I started reading, I fell asleep.
There's a certain digital exhaustion that is overtaking us, I think. And I didn't do shit this weekend. I don't remember the last time I did shit, but I'm very fascinated with how people are occupying their time, because I feel like I'm just regressing and devolving just as a human being.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm happy to be here recording still. This gives me some purpose. Also, the first time I've realized I've said words out loud today, but I'm glad to be joined by a very special guest to say these words with. We're joined by Gabrielle Horton. She's here the whole time. And yeah. I just realized we're all wearing muscle tanks of some type.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if that's for me to jump in.
Oh, yeah. No? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. You could have jumped in at any time. Anytime would have been allowed.
Cool.
Just cut me off whenever, please.
Now, muscle tanks, it's how we sort of brave this July. Like,
exactly.
The humidity wave that we're experiencing in Los Angeles.
Yeah. And when you're podcasting, we were saying this before we started recording, we turn off our AC in case the audio gets, like, I don't know, fuzzy. And so...
Yeah.
We're really suffering for you guys, is what we're trying to say. This is hard stuff.
Yeah, it feels like it. Well, not producing stuff for people, but just like the process of getting there.
Yeah.
Like, oof, yeah. Need a break.
Well, actually, I don't turn my AC off because it's in a different room, so it doesn't even affect my recording. I just close the door and hope for the best.
I'm in the same room, so it doesn't work for me. Okay, spoiler alert, Gabrielle works in podcasting.
Oh, yeah.
But I want to rewind a little bit. Your trajectory is a very fascinating one, and I want our listeners to really get to know how you got to where you are today, which is, again, if you have a fascinating story, and I want to hear it. But let's start with where you grew up and what your upbringing was like. What do you remember about your childhood?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Inglewood, California, which I guess if you're not from Los Angeles, you may or may not have heard of the city watching Insecure, you know, Issa Rae's show on HBO. Because I get a lot of folks now like, oh, like, do you know those places? And I'm like, oh my God, this is like a whole city before the show started. But yes, I do know those places. So I'm from Inglewood, which really, like, if you are an LA person, LA native, it's just LA, really. Like, obviously, it's its own city, but that's where I'm from. And it's interesting because I feel like it's only over the past several years that I've really kind of just like claimed that and not just like I'm from Los Angeles. I think there was always like a bit of a shame, especially because I ended up going to Harvard Westlake School for middle school and high school. It's like as much as I could distance myself from whatever people thought Inglewood was, right? Like all the negative stereotypes and not realizing I had a very safe and really beautiful childhood. So it's interesting. There's like this reclaiming of sorts that I think we're seeing publicly, but also to start like on a very personal level. So that's home for me. I live in Los Angeles. My family is kind of spread out through Black LA, which is like View Park, Baldwin Hills, Leimert Park, Crenshaw area, and a few kind of scattered maybe mid-city or elsewhere. But my mom's side of the family were all pretty concentrated, you know, within 5 miles of everyone. So that has a lot to do with my upbringing too, you know, growing up in a very sort of communal, family-centered. So yeah, so all of my mom's family, right, like extended family and relatives, like we all are kind of within a 5 mile radius of each other. So that had a lot to do with like how I was raised, right? And a lot of women, and also a lot of like gay and queer folks growing up too. So that was just like my norm. But it took some time, I think, and I'm sure we'll get into this on the show, you know, throughout this conversation. It was like I had all of these like really interesting and really powerful representations of like Blackness, but Blackness itself was never really talked about growing up. So it was really interesting. Like I had all of like the visual, I had all the visuals, right? And like definitely immersed like in place as well, like in communities that like were Black and brown. And but it took a while, I think, to be able to sort of like articulate like what that meant and what it could look like and the history behind it. So that was kind of like my journey to, I had to kind of figure out on my own, you know? So I had a really great childhood. I don't know. I was like a huge bookworm. I'm an only child. My mom and dad divorced pretty early on, lived with my mom. So it was like the two of us and had like this really like, I don't know. She was like really obsessed with like health foods and running. So I was taking wheatgrass shots at 7 years old and like running kids marathons and like just always in some kind of like arts or public speaking or just, you know, that kind of just a lot of programming. I feel like I was always busy as a kid, which That's is like, good. I don't know how good that is. But those are some of the memories I have of being a kid and growing up in LA in Inglewood.
Yeah.
I feel like growing up, we like go away from ourselves because we just don't know how to explore. We just don't have like, I feel like the words or even like the tools we need to understand our like our upbringing or like our family. Or like I was, you know, I was raised by Iranian immigrants and I was always like trying to hide that aspect because my parents had really thick accents and people would make fun of me. So I was always trying to hide that side of me to be like, no, I'm normal. I'm just like you. Nothing to see here.
Yeah.
And it's like you kind of go away from it and then have to refind yourself, which like I started to do in college when I was also like, oh, I miss my parents cooking. Like, oh, God.
I know. You start to kind of like, oh, I actually really love those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like when you said that, at least for me, I can speak for myself, I could never really hide the fact that I was Black, right?
Right.
Like the
right.
physical markers, though there are Black people who are able to maybe pass a bit more, pass a bit easily. I'm definitely not one of those. And so for me, it was always something that like I was always aware of, at least just thinking about the school setting, because I think you learn so much about so much in schools, even though you really don't have the language to talk about a whole lot of stuff.
Right.
You start to see how things play out. And especially, I think, going to a school like Harvard Westlake, where, like, there's so much wealth, right? And, like, a huge population of sort of white folks there and just crazy amounts of wealth. So you're seeing a lot of things play out on a day-to-day basis. It wasn't something I could really hide from, but it was something that I was like, how can I shape this blackness into something else that maybe is a bit more digestible for other people around me? And I think towards like my senior year or so, I kind of was like, I'm kind of tired of doing this, but I didn't know why. I didn't have like, again, I didn't have like the tools to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, Anna, just kind of like spending time in college trying to sort of relearn myself and obviously my family and culture and history through that way. But yeah, no, it's what a journey.
Yeah.
It sounds like it sounds like you had these two opposing sides of LA like in your upbringing. Like where, like, it's like as far as like the real LA, where it's like a very dominant Black community thriving, like Black empowerment. And then you're in this very white rich school. And
That is not empowering us.
No, it's not empowering you. And I think it's really beautiful that your memories of your upbringing and your childhood are filled with these, with your family being close by, and filled with these powerful women in your life. Because I think like subconsciously must have really shaped who you are today. And I think similar to what both of you were saying about having to leave and like figuring it out, I think you don't really have that perspective on your life until you have like, you step back.
Yeah.
But I remember being really envious of people that had family nearby, because it was just my parents and I for the most part growing up. Like, I mean, I have sisters, but like all our families in Syria and scattered. So I think, and we were the only Syrians in school. And and I do have a privilege of like kind of being light skinned and people like thinking I was Latina or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's really unfortunate that you had to make yourself more palatable to white people.
Yeah.
I think I'd like to explore what that meant and like how you were able to like realize what that was doing. But to come back home and then be surrounded by this different kind of life and then not being able to like express that, I think it's kind of tragic, but now beautiful in a way that you can like recognize it.
Yeah, it definitely took some time, because I think that when you're in the thick of things, right, kind of like what we're talking about, when you're in the thick of things, you can't really see a whole lot. And so, and I think especially when you're in middle school and high school, like, I didn't know shit. You know what I mean? Like, I think you know how you feel, right? You know if someone makes you feel good. You know if an experience, like, how you leave feeling. Like, you know your feelings, but again, you maybe not have all the words that you really sort of want to tap into to be able to describe something. So it's interesting, because I think, and maybe that's just with time, definitely much more appreciative of what home means to me now, of the fact that I do have family nearby, right? But I think when you're kind of going between, sometimes for me, it was like three different worlds. It was like home was one thing, because I wasn't really like, I didn't like have neighborhood friends or anything. Like, I didn't play outside. Like, that was not like, it was, my mom and I were actually just talking about that a couple months ago, is that I didn't really like have like that kind of normal neighborhood experience. You know, it was like when we were home, like, you know, my mom, she owned a condo in Inglewood. And so we were at home, you know, and if we weren't at home, I was either at activities or school. She was at work. We were at family's houses, you know, but I didn't really sort of go outside to play. So it was always a pretty kind of like, I'm with my mom or I'm with like a family friend as like when I leave my house. So there's that, right? Which is sort of like, okay, that's just home base, where you come to sleep and recharge, if you will. Then there's school, that's Harvard Westlake's between, they've got a campus in like Bel Air and Holmby Hills, and then another one in the Valley. So that's a whole other world. And then I had some really close friends who were in public school, like in high school. So that was, because they were kind of scattered throughout the city. So that was a whole other life too that I got to kind of tap into. So I'd finish studies at Harvard Westlake. I'd be done with classes early. And then I'd be at the football game at Fairfax High School having my best life. And then I got to go home, right? Yeah. So it was like, I had a few different hats I was wearing. And I think that it, you know, I think when I think back on that, it definitely took a toll on me. And I never felt comfortable, you know, I never felt comfortable kind of wherever I was. You know, I was always like, It is so cliche, and I hate when I see these damn things on Twitter where people are like, oh, you know, like, you know, you're not black enough for this crowd, or you're not white enough for, like, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, it's kind of true, but it's, mm-hmm. it's, I also hate it because I feel like it's right. so overused, but it was like that, you know, and I was home, it was like, oh, you sound like a white girl, and oh, you're, you know, I was kind of just made to feel othered, even though I'm not the one who chose to go to this school, you know, it's like, so as adults, you have to also find a way to bring kids in who are going through those different experiences. No one ever really sat down to talk with me for real, for real. Right. And then when I'm at school, you know, I mean, definitely not feeling empowered and encouraged, you know, mm-hmm. and like living my best life as like this young black girl. And we just, there were so many memories, I think, of just sort of like, you know, a lot of teasing and taunting, you know, honestly, you know, kind of kids can be kind of cruel sometimes. I think yeah. we experience that, especially as black students and especially the black girls growing up. So you're just kind of navigating all these things and not really ever sort of made to feel or invited to feel comfortable in like who you are, what you're interested in. It's always, you know, it was always something. And so I think it just took me some time and a lot of therapy to kind of
right.
kind of dig through those things. Right. Like, what does any of it really mean? And does it mean yeah. anything, you know? So,
yeah,
it's been an interesting journey.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that, because I was, you know, again, you know, I have the luxury of being white passing.
Yeah.
And I mean, I do still, you know, everyone thinks I'm from somewhere, but they know.
Yeah.
It's very hard to be like, Iranian, you know, no one ever says that. But I always felt other than that way, too, because like, you know, you never feel like you fit in, like at school, you know, I also went to like a nice private school that like because, you know, Persian parents can, or just most immigrants can sometimes just be like inherently racist because they're taught the same shit.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. That's white supremacy for you.
Yeah, exactly. They teach you.
It gets everybody.
You want to be white because that's how you'll be treated better. So for them, they come in and be like, we have to be as white as possible. And it's like, you're just disregarding all this like, white supremacy that's from a different country ingrained into you. So my parents came to America. They were like, this is the skin tone we have to be the closest to, even though it technically isn't ours, because we want to be respected and live a nice life. And it's like this really deeply ingrained bullshit that we have.
It's deep.
Yeah, it's so deep. And it's like, that's, like you said, the power of white supremacy, what it can do from here to Iran. It's like, it's so disconnected, yet there's no disconnect at all. And so I always felt like very confused because I got put in this private school because my parents are like, your brother's going to join a gang. And you're like, what? Well, I grew up in the Bay Area, like Berkeley, Oakland. So they were very terrified all the time. Like public school equaled gang. Like it it's just not... It didn't compute how I would be like, no, I mean, it's like any other person who can't afford to live a nice life and like, go to this over the top private school that I also personally thought was kind of bullshit. I was like, we're paying too much. This is bullshit.
Whole other
like,
topic,
These people. I mean, but just to say, like, I never felt okay there because I was legitimately the only Persian person that these people have ever interacted with. And then I go home and my dad's like, you've become so Americanized. And I'm like, I don't know who I am. And then I go to Iran and they're like, American cousin, look at her being so free. She's showing her arms. And I'm like, what do you guys want from me?
It's like, what do you want? Especially at like 12. It's like, what do you want? You know, just make it plain. Cause like no one knows what's going on at like 12, 13. I mean, really, I feel like until I hit like 25, I didn't really know what was going on in life.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, let me know what it is you want for me. Cause it's hard trying to juggle all of those expectations, you know?
Yeah. Did you have any resentment about being sent to that school compared to like your friends that went to public school? Like,
That's interesting.
What was your parents' reasoning behind sending you there in the first place? Because you mentioned it wasn't your choice.
Yeah. So actually, it was pretty carefully thought out, like when I was like maybe 3 or 4 years old, like kind of like where I'd be going to school, right? And so for LA, you know, I think it's the second largest school district in the country, but one of the most underperforming of them all. And so where I lived actually was not even in LAUSD sort of district. It was actually within Inglewood, right? School, a public, I don't know, in Inglewood Schools District, maybe, whatever, but I was in sort of like that area. And so in terms of the choices, right, there are choices for schooling, but in terms of the outcomes, like how students sort of were performing and going to college, they were low. I can't speak for how they are right now, but definitely at the time, they were not definitely, they were definitely not where my mother wanted them to be. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think in seeing that, it was sort of, so my parents divorced early, but my godfather is, you know, one of my mom's best friends and like just a huge, incredible figure in my life. He had older daughters who had kind of done a similar thing, what I'm going to explain, which is that elementary school, the goal was like, okay, Gabrielle will attend like an all black Lutheran school that both of his daughters had went to. We had other family friends who had gone through, and they had a really sort of rigorous like education, rigorous curriculum, I should say. And so, and it was small, with small classes, you know, there was sort of like the private school element, right? The uniform, mm-hmm. and then the religious aspect in too. So you have like your Bible classes, like it was all of that. Mm-hmm. And it was not too far from where we lived either. It's like in the Hyde Park, on that Hyde Park View Park border, kind of near Crenshaw and Slauson. And so that was the plan. So from kindergarten through sixth grade, that's where I was in school. So imagine going, and I sometimes think about this and when I just have some free time, imagine being from like 4 years old to like 11 years old, all of your teachers are black, all of the administrators are black. And when I say black, I mean across the diaspora. And I didn't even know that at the time, right? I had like Belizean teachers, right? Like I had Afro-Latino teachers. I had teachers of different ages and gender and sexuality identities, but I didn't know all of that then, right? But I had like this very loving sort of like educational environment from kindergarten through six. And the whole plan was like, okay, she'll have that foundation being in an all black environment. And then when it's time to go to school, you know, given how she does on testing and let's really aim for, they call them in LA, like independent schools. So I feel like they're like a notch above private school, a lot for the price tag and like the exclusivity of it all. But that was sort of like the plan. Like, let's have her do all black, small private school, do really, really well there. And then she's got that foundation. That was the plan. I really wish it had kind of worked out like that. Like in terms of like actual steps it did, right? I went from one school to the next school, but I think maybe they thought that that foundation from kindergarten through sixth grade was going to like really carry on. I'd have a sense of like, I feel comfortable in my skin and I'm comfortable to speak up. And I didn't have that. It didn't carry over. Cause I feel like as soon as I kind of got into that new environment, like those are all the things that were kind of seen as everything that I was and was proud of being at like 11 and 12 years old was, I got so many no's about it, you know? So mm-hmm. I think that the plan in theory would have been really great, but I think I was missing some conversations, and my mom and I have talked about that. I was like, there were some conversations that needed to have happened regularly, but definitely like when the transition happened, you know, like what to look out for, how to talk about this, how to navigate this, how to speak about this, how to come home to me and tell me like when you're not feeling well about something. Mm-hmm. I was missing a lot of that because going back to what we're talking about, I think so much, you know, so many parents, especially like non-white parents, immigrant parents, parents who are maybe upwardly mobile for the first time, they're seeing these kind of schools or institutions like them that are just going to be able to provide like this fast track for their children to have the success, which we kind of translate into more money, maybe less stress, right? All of those things, and not realizing that like going through the process, you still have to be a whole person throughout.
Yeah.
And I don't think, and you know, my mom and I have definitely talked about it, and obviously hindsight is 2020, and she's like, yeah, you're right. I could have done that differently, but I was missing that. So to answer that, that was like the plan. It was like, I've had these like two vastly different experiences. And then by the time I go and get to college, I have my pick of the litter. That was like their whole game plan. And I don't know that I had any resentment in my mom really wanting me to go to an independent school. I think I had resentment that like I didn't have anyone to talk to when things were really rough.
Yeah.
And I didn't have anyone to talk to when I was being teased in seventh grade, or when, you know, during lunch breaks, groups of white kids are calling all of us like the scholarship kids and poor kids. And we're from it was even worse than that. Do you know what I mean? But there was no one to really come back home to talk to and be like, well, what does that mean? You know, like, why are they saying that? Or why does my teacher not feel like I can take this like more advanced class? You know, like I didn't know how to talk about those things. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there was an environment at home for that. So I think if anything, my resentment is about that and not so much like my mom seeing this as a way for me to have better schooling.
Right. That makes sense.
It was just, I miss the conversations.
You know? I want to talk more about that after a quick commercial break. We'll be right back with more Gabrielle.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
And we're back. I think you brought up something really interesting before the break. The fact that non-white parents or immigrant parents, they're so set on providing their kids with the best opportunities ever that I think a lot of our cultures, emotional intelligence is not very taught, and like talking about your feelings or recognizing what they are is not like the priority. And I still have trouble as an adult figuring out what I'm feeling, like putting a name to an emotion and like figuring out why I feel a certain way. And I think it's because we're not taught these things as kids. We're not given an environment at home where it's like, how are you feeling? It's more like, how did you do on this test? You know, it's I think in retrospect, you're right, like hindsight's 20/20, and your mom's probably like, you're right, I should have been doing XYZ differently. But at the time, I'm sure our parents were just trying their best for us in their own way.
Right. And I think that's also part of adulthood. Like, I think there's like a couple like moments in adulthood where I feel like I had some significant breakthroughs. And one was when I finally not just like intellectualized, but like fully understood and realized that like, your parents, you know, in my case, like my dad left when I was 3, right? But stayed in LA, had another family, remarried, did the whole thing. It took me a long time to realize, like, he is just a human being who happened to become a father, right? But means he's dealing with his own highs and lows, right? Mm-hmm. His own traumas, his own stressors. And even if I don't want to sort of dive deep into that world with him, I had to come to a place where I had to understand and respect that. Because I think when you put your parents in that light versus like these heroes that are supposed to do and know all, it can be, they're never really going to meet your expectations. But when you kind of, you know, start to realize like they're humans and they're going to make some mistakes and they happen to be parents, but they're a whole person beyond and before me, you know, and after me. And that's hard, you know, and that takes some time. That was easier to accept with my dad than it was with my mom. And I think it's just because maybe it's the mother-daughter relationship and we're closer, but it took me a while to kind of really kind of forgive her in some ways for that or allow myself a chance to sort of like, allow us a chance to sort of like acknowledge that together and then think about ways. Even now we talk about like, how can we communicate our feelings differently or better? Mm-hmm. Right. And we're both kind of uncomfortable with it. And even when I'm in therapy, I'm like hella uncomfortable. I'm like, you know, everyone knows me as someone who's like, oh, you can speak up with here and you speak up about this. And you speak up when it comes to my feelings, though, my personal feelings about like how I'm doing, not about how I feel about you, but how I feel about myself and like how I feel inside. It's really uncomfortable for me. And so I'm learning, I think therapy has been literally one of the biggest blessings too of my adulthood, but like learning how to communicate about myself to others, or at least just to myself first, that takes a lot of work. So then, you know, you realize you're like, damn, of course my parents don't have that. They were not in therapy then. Yeah. You know, my grandmother, you know, my grandparents moved from Louisiana in like the 30s. They weren't focused on like how to do these things with therapeutic care in mind. Right. You know, like people are trying to survive and, and live. And unfortunately, like one's emotional well-being, mental health, just how someone is doing internally is not always sort of seen as a priority when it comes time to sort of like, you know, getting through the day. But I think we're realizing that more and more. You know what I mean?
I hope so, too. I hope so. Yeah. I think as far as survival goes, a lot of people, especially previous generations or different cultures, they assume that survival means, and to their credit, like physical stuff. Like
totally.
Like money, food, shelter. Like those are the things we need to secure, not realizing that mental health is it's needed for survival too. Those things don't matter if you're falling apart, you know what I mean? So
at all. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about how you ended up where you got to where you are today. So I'm assuming that maybe your relationship with your mom got better as you, when you left, because I feel like a lot of people need that distance.
It actually took even more time than that, funny enough.
Really?
Yeah, it took a while. It took a minute.
I wanted to bring that up only to hopefully segue to you going to college.
No, we can totally segue. I guess to answer that question in short, it's like, my mom and I, we've always been in each other's life. Like, that's my girl. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We've had some moments where things have been rougher than others, or we're having less understanding than other periods in our life. But like, never for a second in my life or hers have I ever thought she's not going to have my back or I can't call. You know what I mean? So even when there was like, we're not really on the same page with like maybe fundamental stuff or this or that, like I always knew that she was like just an amazing person. And I just always hope that one day we're going to get to a place, and I'm so happy we are there now. But I say that to say, a lot of my journey to this point, a lot of it felt kind of solo, because it was stuff I really couldn't communicate to my family. They understood like college, and they understood like law school or medical school, maybe a couple others if I'm feeling fancy. But I had a lot of interests. I was switching my majors all the time, in my first 2 years.
You're preaching to the choirs here.
I was living like a normal kid life. You know, I was like, I like this week. I want to do an econ major. Actually, no, I want to do history. Like, I did a lot of that, but I really found a lot of, I don't know the word, maybe it's joy. I found a lot of comfort. I found myself very home in classes that had to do with like American studies and history and sort of Black studies and sort of women and gender studies. I found my home there, not really knowing what to do with it, right? Given how limited I had of a view of like what life after would look like. But it would take one summer. I actually had an internship on Capitol Hill with Congressman John Lewis, and that changed the course of my life. For obvious reasons, right? Like, I'm with the whole veteran of a congressman, right? Who is like the things that we read about in history books as it relates to sort of being on the front lines demanding for justice and equality for Black people, but people all across this country, right? And that was going into my senior year. I mean, it was transformational on so many levels, but it gave me that. I got really excited about thinking about policy and politics in a way that could be translated to communities in really tangible ways and really accessible ways. And so as an intern, I did everything you can imagine. But also, I also was working with a team and for, you know, a Congress member who allowed me to come to committee meetings, allowed me to speak up, allowed me to sit at the table when there were meetings happening in the office, and not just like, just go hang out by the water cooler, you're an intern. So I also learned what leadership could look like really early on. And in some ways I may have been and may still be kind of chasing that, you know, or trying to see that realized in all the projects that I do. So that was one of my first internships. And in long story short, that kind of like was my first sort of political, I got bit by the political bug at that point, right? And I'm thinking, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be, I'm going to be a public interest lawyer. I'm going to be, you know, just do all these things, a public defender. I had all these ideas. And then I ended up joining the Obama campaign, their election campaign in 2012. And then I was like, oh, I really love talking to people, but I also really love listening to people. And I think that was when I first started learning how to actively listen, which I'm still practicing. But I realized the power of storytelling. I realized the power of conversations, to not just sort of like connect with one another or with someone else or groups of people, but to actually mobilize for change. And it sounds kind of maybe like a little what, but it's real, right? Like connecting with people to understand how policy and the sort of proposals people are just casually talk about on cable news, how people are interpreting that on like the ground level, like real people talking about how this actually impacts their life. I love that. I still live for that. And so I end up sort of working on that campaign and then others afterwards. And then eventually for Mayor Garcetti here in Los Angeles, where I oversaw public engagement for South LA, which again, home. And so that kind of came full circle. But that was my last sort of like job within like a government entity, because I think at that point I realized, you know what? Like I've worked for some really sort of really awesome leaders, folks who are going to go down in history books, but I'm still not seeing the kind of connectivity and engagement that I think that Black folks deserve. Because a lot of the communities I was assigned to were Black. And sometimes it would be Black and brown. And by brown, I mean like usually like Latinx, Central American immigrant communities, Mexican immigrant communities. Those are mostly the ones I kind of feel like I worked in, but always Black communities, right? And so I just was like, there's gotta be a different way to communicate. I may not be the one who's writing the policy, and I was okay with that, but I was like, there's gotta be someone else who's going to, something else that can allow us a chance to really sort of gather and have some really hard conversations together and also think through what solutions can look like. So I guess I was always really drawn to this idea of radically like reimagining society and then thinking about ways to radically change it. But I didn't even know those words then. I just like, we gotta do something. Yeah. And I didn't know a job title for what I was really interested in doing. You know, it was just like, I really love doing this and this. And I went to grad school. For me, it was like 2 years, like, let's press pause. Let's try and think about new ways to attack these same old ass problems. And grad school was awful. You know, for me, it was 2 years of like being actually just like severely depressed, but like still being highly productive. So like, just kind of like, that's just like not good, right? Like not a good combo.
Were you still pursuing like political stuff at that time, or was it?
So I was studying public policy. So I went to Michigan I have to mention, because just I can't not say this, I went to Spelman College for undergrad. I got to just say those words out loud in case there's anyone listening, right? Yeah. Who just needs to hear that. I went to Spelman. I'm a proud, proud, proud Spelman alumna. And, but when I got to grad school, Michigan, it's interesting because so much of the foundation that my mom and godfather were like, we're going to plan for you in your early adolescence, that's actually what I kind of ended up doing. So before I got to Spelman, I did Tufts University for 2 years. Then I was like, you know what? This is still Harvard Westlake feeling. Let's go somewhere else. So I switched to Spelman. So by the time I got to grad school, I think I had maybe 4 or 5 years from the time I graduated undergrad. At that point, I can honestly tell you, I was very sort of like aware of who I was. I was aware of my Blackness. I was aware of like my position in society. I was aware of all the structures and forces and all those like big and weird academic words. But I just was like aware of myself, right? And I think that repositioned me going into grad school as well. And so I was studying public policy. And I was kind of interested in maybe going the philanthropy route, thinking about the role of communications and sort of helping it translate policy into stories and back and forth. And grad school was just, academically, it was fine, you know, it was everything else about grad school. It was awful. But it was in going into my second year where I realized, you know, I'm spending a lot of time just consuming media, whether it's podcasts, Twitter, Facebook at the time, a lot of news articles, a lot of TV. Like, I was consuming a lot of media, not like more than I probably like most of us, but I realized like I had a lot, I enjoyed it a lot too. And I was always thinking about, wow, I wish I could do this, or I wish I could like talk to this person, or I wish I could hear more. I was always thinking about media. But again, I had never been told, oh, this is what you could really do to leverage this background and this skill to do this. And it just so happened that there is an NPR member station, and literally that is like owned by the University of Michigan, so Michigan Radio. I started working there as a production assistant. So, you know, I was still in grad school taking classes and stuff, but you know, several times a week I'd go and work in the newsroom, and then I ended up working on their daily show stateside. And that's for me when media really kind of became like a thing that I really saw was like, oh, this is an achievable goal you know, me working in media. Now, I knew I wasn't going to stay at an NPR type of organization just because I'm very unfiltered. I was tired of kind of like sticking to a script because I had done that for so many years working for other people. And I knew wherever I went, I just kind of wanted to be able to speak my piece, right? And speak what I felt to be like the truth. And also to do something that was just really cool and at the nexus of like politics and policy and communities, you know, local communities and Black folks and queer folks and immigrant folks. Cause like I wanted all of people to feel, you know, to feel seen and heard through whatever I did. So that kind of started that journey. It's like definitely a lot of detours. But in my mind, I think they all really build on each other and they all inform like what I do now, especially as an independent podcast producer and showrunner and host. It's definitely all has informed like how I've gotten to this point and like what I do now. So that's like a little bit about my journey. It's a wild story. There's some crazy parts in that for another time, but you know, all in all, I made it out alive and, you know, live to tell it.
I mean, of course I was the same way where I didn't, it's not like I could tell my parents. Like, I honestly just didn't know how to explain what I wanted to do. It's like, I want to get into media. Right. And my Persian parents are like, no. When are you going to law school? And I was always
like, oh, they're still waiting for me to go to law school.
Same.
Never ending.
Same. I only recently did my dad be like, okay, okay, you're making good money. And I was like, Jesus Christ, please just keep thinking that and leave me alone. But it took a very long time. Because I didn't know I was like going to become a podcast producer. I had no idea what I was.
I don't know if any of us knew that when we were like, go, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, no one knew
that. I was like just studying like production of all kinds and lying to my parents and saying I was doing computer science because I was like working on a computer.
That's so funny.
They like wouldn't realize. And it's not like my parents are also like Persian and immigrants. So like they weren't making the connection. Like I could, I wouldn't be like, it's actually like I'm editing on computers. Like you don't know. So whatever.
It's only, hard to explain that.
Only at graduation, my dad's like, why are you sitting with the arts kids? And I'm like, nothing to see here. Just keep moving. I have a diploma. That's all you need to worry about.
That is so, so funny. Yeah. My family, like they definitely know I do podcasts now, but it's interesting because I think that like, what made it seem legitimate to them was when they started seeing maybe two things. One is like when I first started, so when I was working at Michigan Radio, I would send kind of like maybe monthly or like bi-monthly kind of like newsletters, if you will, to like my family. Because all my family and friends, you have to realize, like everybody's back here in LA. So I'm like the kind of the odd one of the entire family, extended family, who's like left for considerable parts of her life and like considerable chunks of time too. So I'm always the odd one. So I always was sending emails anyways, but you know, I started sending those. So people kind of at least knew like, okay, she's doing some real like reporting, working on real shit, you know, like she's not making it up. And so I would send those, but I feel like for my family, I think it's like when they would see me producing shows where they were like big guests they recognize, right? Like your Gabrielle Union's, your Ava DuVernay's, like your Spike Lee's. Like my family's like, oh, you produced it. And I'm like, I did, you know? But like, it's so crazy because like, that's not why I got into podcasting. I just happened to be producing shows that, you know, sometimes we have celebrity guests. But that was never my goal into getting into this. So it's, but I realized that like those names and like those kind of big topics that they can relate to, that's what makes them realize like, oh, she's doing this. And I'm okay with that, you know? However somebody I like understands it.
For me,
you get it?
For me, it was Reza Aslan and my mom. When Reza Aslan was on the podcast, when she knew that he knew that we existed, she was like, oh,
game changer. Like, game changer.
I get it. Like, great. And she gave me her book for him to sign. It was just like,
it's a game changer.
Yeah. And if that's what it takes for them to like kind of understand kind like that it can be a real path to whatever type of career we want to have. But I want to talk about more your current projects.
Yeah.
But let's take one more break.
Sure.
So we'll be right back.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates.
Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
And we're back. So we mentioned that the seed of podcasting, the idea of radio, we're talking to people, got planted in grad school. When you moved back to LA, like, how did you get started? Because you mentioned you're an independent podcast producer and you produce like literally an award-winning podcast with Roxane Gay and Tressie McMillan, Cotton.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you go from the seed to producing this podcast and then making your own like docuseries essentially?
Yeah, what a journey. So when I was at Michigan Radio as a production assistant, you know, I knew that my time obviously in grad school was wrapping up, right? Like I was heading closer to graduation. But I ended up staying at Michigan Radio through the end of that summer, and that allowed me a chance to really sort of build up my portfolio, getting a lot of experience sort of doing different facets of sort of like, you know, I learned what it meant to sort of be on a daily news team, right? And so thinking about all the different sort of roles and sort of tasks that are needed to sort of bring a show to life, right, that airs daily. And so I got a chance to sort of do that and get some really cool bylines, you know, and have something to be able to show as I started sort of essentially, I kind of started the application process for like different jobs and fellowships and whatnot. You know, I had my share of rejections from fellowships that were just set where I had my heart set on something and it didn't work out. But eventually I had like, you know, I really wanted to sort of experience Crooked Media. At the time it was, and I don't follow them too much now, but at the time they were like this huge sort of like phenomenon, right, coming out of the 2016 election. And so I was really sort of interested in what it could be like to be at like a really new and like really young company that is thinking about politics in this way. A lot of folks there were also like former Obama people too. So you have some level of sharedness, if you will. And so I knew like, oh, I wanted to either get there either as an intern or full-time or whatever it could be. And that came true. So I ended up interning there. I was like the only like graduate student, like, you know, I was like the age of all the other employees, but I was okay with it because I knew like I hadn't really worked in media before. And I was back home in LA. So, you know, and I say that to say too, just like getting into this business, like there were a lot of different privileges and advantage points that I had that I don't always think are going to be as accessible to everyone else. Like coming back home to LA was never a question, right? I always knew that I could fall back in LA. And not a lot of folks can say that, right? I always knew that I could come back home, that I would have a home to come back to, you know? So there were also a lot of these other sort of things that were already in place that made me able to really sort of explore podcasting, right? As like a 28-year-old or 27, however old I was, but like to be able to do so with a level of nimbleness, you know, and kind of like, I'm going to intern for like 4 months and like just learn and network. Like, what a dream. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it was definitely not peachy, did not have always the best experience doing so. But when I look back, and even then, I was thankful for it because it allowed me to figure out what I liked and what I don't like, which I think that's been a lot of my life, realizing things I don't like. So it's kind of been like narrowing down the list as opposed to like finding all these things I love. It's been like, I actually really don't like that. I don't like that. You know, like I'm very clear about that, which people sometimes take differently, but I think you have to know just as much as what you like and love, and also what you don't like and what you don't want to be a part of. And so I feel like that was most of my life as a working adult. But so anyways, getting those experiences, I was always setting up coffee dates. I was asking folks to connect me with other friends that worked at X, Y, and Z company or X, Y, and Z show. And sometimes it didn't even matter if it was just in podcasting. I wanted to talk to people who were working in TV and film. I wanted to hear how people were thinking about creating content, right? At the nexus of all these things and with the focus on Black people, Black folks, Black communities. And so I literally was like always, I feel like I had like a coffee date or like a phone call every week with someone. It felt like over 6 months, you know? So I was definitely putting in work in a lot of areas, you know, keeping the portfolio tight and like eventually, you know, showing up, whatever my work duties were, whether it was at Michigan Radio or Cricket Media. And then also doing all of that networking, and it was exhausting, and that shit cost too, which is a whole other conversation too. And so I knew something would pan out. You know what I mean? Like I think I had a certain level of confidence in myself and the work that I was doing, even as like, yeah, like I was an intern, but I was like 28. So people kind of know like, okay, she's worked before, right? Like she's just switching careers. So I never really doubted it. Like, am I going to be able to find something? It was more so a question, will I be able to find a project or a team that I really feel like connected to in a really meaningful way? Cause that meant a lot to me then as it does now. So I've worked in some work environments that have been really, really toxic. And I was like, how can I do all these things? How can I do work, really creative and original work for people like me, right? Who come from where I come from or who want to feel seen or heard. So that mattered a lot to me. And so that also made my kind of decision-making process a little bit more selective. And I eventually ended up working for a small production company here in LA. And let's just say things didn't go so well, right? Like, I hope they're doing some public reckoning of their own right now through the midst of all of this. But that's where I met Roxanne and Tressy when they just started their show here to Slay on Luminary. And so I was working with them as their lead producer. And so we just continued the working partnership outside of that old company. And it's turned out, you know, we're in second season now. We just, you know, came back. And so, yeah, I mean, but that took a lot of learning, still a lot of learning, because they were like essentially my first clients, if you will. And I knew that the portfolio would grow and I knew that I wanted to do original stuff, but I was never really rushing anything. I wanted things to kind of come organically. But around the same time that I started working with them independently is when I got the idea for Natal, which is the podcast docuseries that I started along with Martina Abraham-Zalunga last year in 2019. So I had a few things kind of going at the same time, but here to Slay, it's been incredible. And that was kind of the journey, you know? And so I had all these skills and I had worked on some really cool shows for almost 2 years. And I was excited to be able to apply that to Here to Slay and work with a team that was really committed to the same vision of helping to amplify Roxanne and Tressy's voices in the podcasting world for the first time. And so it's been quite a journey and definitely like a huge sort of like a lesson for me, you know, thinking about just being a creative and working in this space and doing so independently.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
I think it's incredible that your first, like what you call your clients were these like pretty incredible women, like incredible women.
Yeah.
Again, just goes to show like you've always been surrounded by these pretty incredible women, it sounds
like. Yeah, always.
I really love that.
Yeah.
But I want to talk a little bit about how, because it sounds like Natal was like the first thing that you did.
Yeah.
So Natal is a docuseries about having a baby while Black. And I'm curious why you chose this topic and why was it important to you?
So it's interesting because early 2019, I remember saying out loud to someone, I really want to explore this Black maternal health crisis. Because at the time, that's really all I knew it. That's what I called the Black maternal health crisis. And I don't really use that phrasing much anymore. And I'll kind of share why. But that's all I knew. You know, I had read Beyonce's 2018 Vogue cover story. She talked about having preeclampsia with her twins and almost dying, you know, in delivery. And then I think about the stories of Serena Williams, who had to chase down her doctor after giving birth to get a blood transfusion. I think about Olympic gold medalist Allyson Felix, also had complications during her birthing process. So I had seen a few of these like high profile celebrity Black women talk about these like near death experiences that they were having giving birth. So it was something that I think me, along with a lot of other people who were reading these stories, were starting to hear more about, you know, still not enough. at the time, but we were starting to hear more about them in the news cycle on our social media feeds. And so I always kept in the back of my mind, but I just knew that there was something more there. I knew that there was something more, and I didn't know what it was, but I was like, there's something here that we're not talking about, or there's something that we need to be doing more for, or more about. I kind of just like put it on the back burner because, again, I was working the time at a company, and so I had a few other podcasts that I was producing, so my plate was full, you know, so I didn't have a lot of time to think through that. So fast forward, though, to like end of June of 2019, early July, my childhood best friend was expecting her baby. We all knew, you know, we were excited. She had the baby shower coming in July. Baby was supposed to be due in August. The baby came 2 months early because my friend had preeclampsia. And it tried to warn doctors about a lot of the symptoms. So preeclampsia is a pregnancy condition that, you know, the symptoms kind of include high protein levels in your urine. You've got sort of massive swelling, even in the face, but also the legs, feet, and you have skyrocketing sort of blood pressure. And it can, as you can imagine, be near fatal for both the parent and the child. So if it's not addressed quickly, you can easily lose one or both people in the process. Mm-hmm. And there's also postpartum preeclampsia, so something you can develop afterwards. So I'm learning all of this as my friend is telling me, I just had the baby, but the baby's not going to be here for 2 more months. I had preeclampsia. I don't know what happened. Like, do you want to come over? And so I go over to visit with her and her mother and her partner at the time. And she's recounting to me the story of going in for just her normal, what she thought was prenatal checkup, trying to tell them like, hey, I've gained a bunch of weight in 2 weeks. I don't think this is normal. And they're like, you're good. You know, dismissing her concerns, right? Mm-hmm. She's saying, I'm not feeling, you're fine. This is just baby weight. She's like, oh, I don't. And then they take her blood pressure and they're like, oh, we got to rush you into emergency. Like, jeez, you know, we got to induce you right now. Right. Yeah. Had you get listened to someone beforehand. And yeah. So hearing firsthand from, you know, my friend about her experience giving birth 2 months early, not being hurt the first time, right? Not being taken seriously, and then end up developing something that she said, I didn't even know what this word was before I developed it, you know, before they told me. She's like, yeah, no one even warned me about what to look out for. And so you're just, in the moment, I'm not thinking about a podcast. In the moment, I'm like, I'm here for my friend. I'm here to listen. I'm here to be supportive. And I'm just here to listen. But I remember her turning to me several times, like, you got to do something about this. Like, you need to do something. I said, I didn't want to say anything, but I had been interested in doing something around this topic. But wow, like, I think you're right. I don't know what I'm going to do, but like, I hear you, you know? And I took to Twitter when I was visiting her. I just went on Twitter real quick and was like, yo, like, my childhood best friend almost died from preeclampsia, the same condition Beyonce had with the twins. Like, this, like, what's happening to Black mothers in this country is something that we cannot ignore. You know, like, we've got to start talking about it. Well, it went viral. And like, I was not imagining that. Like, I was just kind of like tweeting like I do, like, you know, all my other days. Yeah. I just tweet whatever and people, you know, may like whatever. But it went viral. And in the replies, I think, was the most powerful affirmation for me to move forward with sort of developing it into a more concrete series. I just saw so many people commenting about how they've never talked about it, but they've had preeclampsia, how they lost loved ones and friends and their own parents to it, how they themselves have grappled with it, giving birth, right? Like, or other stories people were sharing about just sort of like just sheer neglect in hospital care. And so you're reading all these stories and none of them are blue check, you know, they're not celebrities replying. These are just like everyday people talking about how they're experiencing care during the birthing process, whether they were giving birth, supporting someone giving birth, or they were the ones being birthed through all of this. And it just, I think, reaffirmed for me that, like, not only is my friend's story valid as hell and worthy of hearing and figuring out how we rectify what's happening in hospitals, there's a whole lot of other people who have maybe similar experiences or know of folks, but also people who just have stories that we just have never heard about that don't even have to be near fatal or negative. Right. And so for me, I think seeing the response just on that one Twitter post alone showed me people are hungry for content that is going to center Black parents' stories, especially when we're talking about birthing, we're talking about pregnancy, we're talking about postpartum, because you hear people talk a lot about us in articles. The journalism talks about us, they analyze us, they analyze our data, mm-hmm. but nobody's ever really talking to parents, groups of parents, a whole bunch of parents, Black queer parents, Black straight parents, Black parents in the Midwest, South, like talking like levels to this, right? Like, there's levels to Blackness, just like there is to storytelling. And I think that, like, just I was just so ready to sort of to just do something that was so clearly needed.
Yeah.
And also to step the hell out the way too, you know? And so it was really cool that one of the people who responded was Martina, who's my co-executive producer, also co-host on the show. And she runs You Had Me at Black, which is a brilliant and beautiful and such a powerful podcasting platform that really just shares the stories of Black millennials on a range of topics and nuances. And it's just a really beautiful podcast if you all ever get a chance to listen to it. And she was like, she hit me up and because I had volunteered on one of their previous seasons to produce. And so we had been in touch already and she saw my tweet and she was like, yo, like, I've really been wanting to do something around the Black maternal health crisis too. Like, if you end up doing something, let me know. I'd love to partner with you on this. And so basically, you know, at that point, I was already independent. So my company, The Woodshaw, and You Had Me at Black went into partnership to create this series. So we probably spent maybe like a few months, maybe 3 to 5 months, kind of just brainstorming and thinking through all the like details, like how many episodes and what do we want to talk about, you know, and a lot of those sort of things, and started applying for grants. But a lot started happening in the latter half of 2019. Mm. So that's how Natal came to be. It was a very personal, it was just really personal. I don't know how else to say. It wasn't me, like in my body, but it was someone close to home and Martina's mom. And we actually, on episode 5 of Natal this season, her mom actually shares her story. Martina's mom had suffered not only a miscarriage, but also the loss of one of her twins, right? And so for Martina, thinking about Black people's birthing and pregnancy experiences was like also hitting close to home for her too. Mm-hmm. So I think we took these personal stories and wanted to really do something and make it super public, because I think it's a lot for us to learn and grow from, and to also celebrate, right? Because not everything is doom and gloom with it. So that's how Natal came to be. And it is, you're right. It's like my first, we'll call it like my first baby.
Yeah. I mean, pun intended.
Yeah. It's like no pun intended, but like all the pun intended, but like literally my first baby. So that's a bit of the journey. But I have to be honest, and like, it couldn't have been possible like if I wasn't producing other shows, right? Because I'm not making, like, me and Martina this season are not like cutting a profit from Natal, right? Now we're setting ourselves up in the business model for, you know, upcoming seasons to be able to do so. But like, we're doing Natal just off of like, we're interested in it. We're interested in the topic. We care about it deeply. But to be able to do a project of this size and caliber, it means I have to still be working with other clients and projects to be able to finance my life, you know, to be able to have a home and, you know, like all the basic things to be able to do that passion project that was going to get done regardless, right? But so there's also that too. Because people like, you know, we talk a lot about like the success and what's going well, but it's like behind the scenes, you have to realize too, like there's some sacrifices being made too to get things out into the world for people to hear and listen to. Yeah. So that's the Natal story.
I feel like I'm constantly reading about how Black women are basically, I mean, just as clear as possible, ignored by doctors. It's like, you're 4 times more likely to die in pregnancy or in birth if you're a Black woman than a white woman. Like, it's truly like, I have to say, I was reading up about Natal earlier today, and I think it's such a great idea because it's so important. Like, people don't talk about it. Like, I feel like I'm constantly reading news about Black women and dying in childbirth and people being like, we need to be talking about this, but like, you don't see it on the mainstream. Like, no one's talking, you don't see it on true mainstream media. No one's being like, this is so disproportionate. Like, this shouldn't be happening. Also, it's been happening for like what? Hundreds of years?
Yeah, for forever.
And it's 2020 and yet we're still letting Black women die at a disproportionate rate than white women. Like, it's to a point where it's like, enough is enough. Yeah. You need to pay attention. And then on top
of
that, now correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I read that, like, I'd hate to say it's like a life hack because this is where the fuck we are in this world. But like, if you feel as a Black person that you're being ignored by your doctor, to have your doctor note that they would not take you serious, or like, no, be like, well, if you're saying no to me and saying that I'm overreacting, can you note it in my medical records?
Oh, interesting.
So it's there, because I believe what I was reading off this article that this woman wrote that I wish I had pulled up, but it was like a few weeks ago and I have to find it. But you have to hold them accountable. Like, you have to be like, this doctor, I came in on this date and this doctor said I was overreacting, because it puts the pressure on them to understand, like, well, if I come back or if I die, if something happens to me, the note is there and it looks bad on you. And that's the sad truth, is that you have to put the accountability on their own career for them to give a fuck about you. So
yeah, the, like, life hacks as you're trying to sort of deliver life. It's wild, you know? Yeah, it's really wild. There's a lot of life hacks. Give a few. I could give a few more, but I think people get the gist of that,
they
right?
Like, they have to go listen, like, to your show.
I mean, because, like, those life hacks that you're talking about right now, you know, are the same life hacks that they kind of tell Black folks growing up, right? Like, you think about the talk that are supposed to be given to, you know, which you always hear, you know, Black families giving to their Black boys about the talk, right? Like, what happens when they go outside, how they should dress, how they should walk. Like, there's all these life hacks of, like, how we should try and beat the system to survive. And it's not to say that those life hacks have not worked and ensured that someone has survived. But the fact that you have to rely on a life hack to keep living or to be seen as valid is the wild part, right? Because there's no problem in somebody putting stuff in the chart, noting stuff. They should be doing that. Yeah. But the fact that it has to be a life hack, or the fact that, like, I'm going through doula training in July, you know, later this month, and I'm really excited about it. It's also one of those things where it's like, the fact that there's so many Black families that feel like they have to have a doula, right? Mm-hmm. Someone in addition to their partner or their parent or their grandparent or whatever, whoever's supporting them. They have to have someone in addition to their support system to come in so that they can be heard, right? And then they can feel supported. And I'm happy to sort of, like, be that person. I'm so excited to be able to do so, because birthing is a really beautiful experience, and it should be beautiful, right? Like, it should be one of the most joyous parts of, like, someone's life if they choose to sort of go through with it, right? And have that experience. But the fact that we have all these, like, different life hacks, it's like, okay, did you use this one? Did I use this one? Or what about the, like, it's like you got folks trying to play, like, mental gymnastics, and they're just trying to deliver a healthy baby. And so I think with NATAL is, like, you know, with NATAL, we extend space for Black parents to share these stories. And there's some parents and stories where, like, not a single thing goes wrong, right? Or they have these joyful birth experiences, and maybe it was just, like, a slight sort of, like, moment with the nurse that they felt very uncomfortable, or they felt disrespected. Or sometimes people had it from the very beginning, right? So we're also trying to show that, like, those statistics that we read about are very real, but there's a lot of other stories in between that, right? Like, these stories of, like, when do we get a chance to hear about Black parents feeling, like, so happy and so complete when that baby hits them on their chest with this first skin-to-skin contact, or that first moment when the baby latches on, or those first moments just, like, gazing into your newborn's eyes. Like, we don't get a chance to hear and celebrate those, you know? And so as we're hearing about, right, and talking about the medical racism that continues to sort of put Black lives, right, like, at stake every single day, and especially in our delivery rooms, we also get to hear about the moments that just make people just smile the most, or that make them cry, tears of joy, or talking about how they love those dishes their family would make them when they were pregnant, or, you know, the way that, you know, the kids said their first words. Like, so there's all these moments that we're trying to weave in, because there's, like, and even with the NATAL team, you know, our team, it took us a while at first to figure out we knew what we were trying to do, but it was like, how are we going to do so, right? How are we going to be able to convey these stories? Because at first it was like, well, do we just talk only about the statistics, like all the bad shit, right? Because there's enough to talk about, and a lot of people whose stories can reflect those, you know, those statistics. But then we talked to some doulas and some midwives who were like, we hope that you all are also able to sort of balance it out with, like, the really joyous sanctity of birth. And they were like, we just hope that you're able to convey that too. And so that really caused us to really sort of shift how we approached the narrative arc for the season. Cause it couldn't have been all doom and gloom. Cause on the other end of those statistics are all the positive numbers, right? Like, if you have, for instance, like, I don't know, let's say 60% of this happens, well, what about the other 40%? We got to tell that too, right? Yeah. And so it's always this dance of, like, what stories we do tell and how we tell them. But it's also geared towards, like, a very solutions-oriented kind of podcast as well. People leave an episode kind of understanding, maybe they know a new question to ask a doctor or a provider. Maybe they know sort of something to sort of look into for themselves, whether it's a resource or maybe a local community, resource or support system. But also just thinking about, like, the fact that they kind of know that they're not alone, and sort of understanding, like, okay, this is how someone dealt with this or that. So it's a lot that we've been trying to sort of, like, juggle with NATAL. It's like highlighting these gross disparities and health outcomes for Black parents across a gender spectrum, right? But also thinking about how to sort of also remind folks of just like how beautiful Black birth is and what it means to sort of carry Black life, especially now more than ever. Yeah. So it's all of those things happening at the same time, you know? So you may cry and laugh in an episode, and that's what we kind of intend, you know? Cry, laugh, smile really hard, and cry some more. That sounds like a natal episode. Pretty standard.
Yeah, I think it's really important and beautiful that you are able to incorporate like Black joy into the podcast, because I think a lot of media that portrays like Black life is like, I think like white people, especially, they're used to consuming Black life in like in a tragic way. Like, you know what I mean? And I think it's really a testament to the show to be able to say like, we're dealing with like a really dysfunctional medical system that ignores Black women and puts them at risk. And it's like, it is what you said, it's medical racism.
Yeah.
And it's so important to highlight those things, but I think to also inject the podcast with like moments of joy is necessary, because there has to be like a glimmer of hope, and I think there is.
Yeah.
But where can our listeners listen to the podcast? Where can they find you on the internet? Tell us what's going on.
What's going on? Okay, so if you want to listen to Natal, you can literally listen to Natal wherever you get your podcast, and that's NATAL. Or you can also visit our wonderful website where you can listen, also access our resource hub, learn more about our team, and that's at natalstories.com. So natalstories.com. And you can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Natal Stories. And if you are so compelled and want to sort of get to know me some more, I guess, and sort of keep up with what I'm doing and other shows I produce, Here to Slay is one of them, but also the Blacklist podcast, which is a really, really dope show. It's in conversation with filmmakers and people who love films about like the revolutionary role that films have played in people's lives and their journeys and, you know, career journeys. Mm-hmm. So all of those things, I'm tweeting about those and all things politics and food and everything else under the sun at Gab Horton. So that's GABHORTON. And that's also my handle on Instagram if you're feeling so compelled. But yeah, that's where people can find me.
And also to our listeners that heard that shout out to the Blacklist, we did have the founder of the Blacklist, Franklin Leonard, on our show.
So y'all already know about the show.
So our audience should be well aware of
the Blacklist. I hope you all are.
I hope you guys are listening. I hope you guys like to Here to Slay. And I hope you guys check out Natal. It is so important, especially now, always. But I think now I'm glad that we're finally giving a spotlight to these stories that are often ignored and that go on in hospitals.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for being on our show. This was an amazing episode. Your story is so compelling, and I'm so glad you're creating content after all. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I'm glad that
thank you for that. That means a lot, because, you know, it's been rough during quarantine, during, I don't know, global uprisings. I don't know the right word to describe what is
just upheaval.
What's happening around us every day. And not all of it is bad, but it can be really hard sometimes just to get up, you know, and just do and work.
I'm
sure you all know too, as podcasters, people who are, you know, in this space as well. So thank you all for recognizing Natal and the show and my work. And it's been so great to talk to you all. Definitely a lovely conversation.
Thank you for joining us. I'm glad. I mean, he's our head of comedy of Big Money Players introduced us.
I love the name of that, by the way.
Hans also was the previous guest, if you guys remember that. I'm talking to our audience now.
Yeah.
Dropping some guest names here and there.
And Hans is the EP for The Blacklist. So that's how Hans and I got connected.
So
he's the executive producer on The Blacklist. Blacklist podcast and the lead producer. So we obviously work very closely together on the show, which is in its first season on Luminary. So so that's how we're all connected. And then Franklin is the host of that. So, you know, we're all family.
We're all family now. It's audio family. But we really do appreciate you and your work so much. And we're just so happy we got to give you the chance to share it. And to our audience, please check out everything that Gabrielle is doing. It is so important. And I'm just excited to see what you continue to make.
Oh, me too. I'm like, what's next?
What's next?
Or not.
I mean, like right now, I think you brought up a good point where it's like, it's really hard to keep going and like to just like remind yourself of like the reason why we do things. I'm having that trouble every single day.
Yeah.
But we just got to do it. And like little things like the replies to your tweet or hearing that someone felt less alone from something you said.
Truly. Truly,
it makes it all worth it. It makes it for me, it makes it worth it. And it reminds me that like my voice sounds like it's echoing into this vast like void of nothing, but it does mean something.
I absolutely agree. We have listeners all over the world, which I'm still baffled by, but not in a bad way. I'm just like, wow, people are literally listening to us across five continents on, you know, for Natal. And sometimes it'll just be like a random like message on Instagram or Twitter or email from maybe it's an OBGYN, maybe it's a parent, maybe it's a loved one, but like they'll just have such beautiful words to share with us about the show. And it's just like when you create something, I'm sure you all know, you put it out there in the world and you hope that people listen, you hope people engage, whatever they do with it, but you don't really know like to what extent it'll grow and where it'll sort of live, right? And so thinking about how people are listening to the show in like Johannesburg and like throughout the Middle
East. It's crazy.
And like in Southeast Asia. Yeah. Like people are like listening and learning about like what Black birthing can be. Like, oh, sometimes it just moves me to tears. So I'm like, that's the power of media and content. And I'm really happy that like I'm here at this point, you know, in my life's journey and at this particular moment in time. I'm just thankful that I can contribute something that maybe can help just to shift one thought or another thought. And so I'm really grateful for that. And it does all the comments and feedback, they make a difference. And
they really do.
Yeah, it can make your day, especially after a long one.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to wrap us out. This has been a lovely conversation. We're Ethnically Ambiguous. You can follow us at Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I'm Shireen. It's Shirohiro on Instagram and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm at Anna Hussein on Twitter.
Yeah. And until next time, listen to Natal.
Yeah, check out Natal.
Follow Gab. Yeah. Can I call you Gab? Oh, just because it's your handle. Oops.
No, it's
we're
fine.
We're already friendly. We're already
I can Gab
so
a lot.
Friendly.
Gab is good. Yeah. Okay. It's funny. I'm getting more used to that. Yes. Yeah, that works.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.